Gathered on deck, including the De Fuentes twins, who were impassive as always, scanning the pirate ship critically as if to assess its worth. Shortly thereafter a boat was lowered and it rowed towards us. Standing in the stern was a slim blonde youth, his gold-braided coat glittering in the sun. Beside him was a youth in short gray pants and shirt with a red scarf around his neck. The boat was rowed by what appeared to be a crew of women, singing as they rowed and turning towards us to leer and wink with their painted faces. The companionway was lowered and the women scrambled aboard with the agility of monkeys and posted themselves about the deck with muskets and cutlasses. I perceived that they were, in fact, handsome youths in women's garb, their costumes being oriental, of colored silks and brocade. The two youths then stepped on board, the one with his gold-braided coat open at the waist to show his slender brown chest and stomach, a brace of pistols inlaid with silver, and a cutlass at his belt. He was a striking figure, blonde hair tied in a knot at the back of his head, aristocratic and well-formed features, possessing a most lordly bearing and grace of manner. Captain Jones stepped forward. "I am Captain Jones, master of the Great White. And I am Captain Strobe, second in command on the Siren," said the youth. They shook hands most amiably and if I am any judge are not strangers to each other. I was immediately convinced that the capture had been prearranged between them. Strobe then received the keys to the armory. Turning to us, he assured us that we had nothing to fear for our lives. He would take over the conduct of his ship and set its course, his men acting under the orders of Mr. Kelly, the quartermaster. He indicated the youth in gray shorts, who was leaning against the rail immobile as a statue, his face without expression, his pale gray eyes turned up towards the rigging. We would continue to act under the orders of Mr. Thomas. Several of the boys descended to the boat and began passing up sea bags containing apparently the personal effects of the boarding crew. When the boat was cleared, Strobe conducted Captain Jones and the De Fuentes twins to the companionway and two boys rowed them back to the Siren. Captain Strobe then opened a small keg of rum and the boys produced tankards from their bags. Approaching us in a purposeful and insinuating manner, wriggling their buttocks, they passed around little clay pipes. "Hashish. Very good." When it came to my turn to smoke it caused me to cough greatly but soon I felt a lifting of my spirits and a vividness of pictures in my mind together with a pric cling in my groin and buttocks. Drums and flutes appeared and the boys began to dance and as they danced stripped off their clothes until they were dancing stark naked on the brightly colored silk scarves and dresses strewn about the deck. Captain Strobe stood on the poop deck playing a silver flute, the notes seeming to fall from a distant star. Only Mr. Thomas, at Strobe's side, seemed totally unconcerned, and for a second his bulky form was transparent before my eyes, probably an illusion produced by the drug. Mr. Thomas was watching the Siren through his telescope. Finally, having received a signal that their sails were set, he gave the order to hoist sail on the Great White. Surprisingly enough, we were able to carry out the order with no difficulty, the effect of hashish being such that one can shift easily from one activity to another. Kelly gave the same order in an unknown tongue to the dancing boys, who now acted in a seamanlike manner, some naked, some with scarves twisted around their hips as they went about their duties singing strange songs. So sails were speedily set and we got underway, for where I did not know. Some of the boys have hammocks and sleep on deck, but we are often two to a bunk in the forecastle. Since we now have a double crew, there is much time with nothing to do, and I have been able to acquaint myself to some extent with the strange history of these transvestite boys. Some of them are dancing boys from Morocco, others from Tripoli, Madagascar, and Central Africa. There are a few from India and the East Indies who have served on pirate vessels in the Red Sea, where they preyed on merchant vessels and other pirates alike, the method of operation being this: some would join the crew of a ship, selling their favors and insinuating themselves into key positions. Then the crew sights an apparently unarmed vessel carrying a cargo of beautiful women all singing and dancing lewdly and promising the mariners their bodies. Once on board, the women pull out hidden pistols and cutlasses, while their accomplices on shipboard do the same, and the siren now uncovers its cannon so that the ship would often be taken without the loss of a single life. Often the boys would sign on as cooks, at which trade they all excel, and then drug the entire crew. However, word of their operations spread rapidly, and they are now fleeing from pirates and naval patrols alike, having, as the French say, Brule burnt down the Red Sea area. Kelly told me his story. He started his career as a merchant seaman. In the course of an argument, he killed the quartermaster, for which he was tried and sentenced to hang. His ship at that time was in the harbor of Tangier. The sentence was carried out in the marketplace, but some pirates who were present cut him down, carried him to their ship, and revived him. It was thought that a man who had been hanged and brought back to life would not only bring luck to their venture but also ensure protection against the fate from which he had been rescued. While he was still insensible, the pirates rubbed red ink into the hemp marks, so that he seemed to have a red rope always around his neck. The pirate ship was commanded by Skipper Nordenhals, a renegade from the Dutch Navy who was still able to pass his ship as an honest merchant vessel flying the Dutch flag. Strobe was second in command. Barely had they left Tangier, headed for the Red Sea via the Cape of Good Hope, when a mutiny broke out. The crew was in disagreement as to the destination, being minded to head for the West Indies. They had also conceived a contempt for Strobe as an effeminate dandy. After he had killed five of the ringleaders, they were forced to revise this opinion. The mutinous crew was then put ashore and a crew of acrobats and dancing boys taken on, since Nordenhals had already devised a way in which they could be put to use. Kelly claims to have learned the secrets of death on the gallows, which gives him invincible skill as a swordsman and such sexual prowess that no man or woman can resist him, with the exception of Captain Strobe, whom he regards as more than human. Voici ma lettre de marque, he says, running his fingers along the rope mark. A letter of marque was issued to privateers by their government, authorizing them to prey on enemy vessels in the capacity of accredited combatants, and thus distinguishing them from common pirates. Such a letter often, but by no means always, saved the bearer from the gallows. Kelly tells me that the mere sight of his hemp marks instills in adversaries a weakness and terror equal to the apparition of death himself. I asked Kelly what it feels like to be hanged. At first I was sensible of very great pain due to the weight of my body and felt my spirits in a strange commotion violently pressed upwards. After they reached my head, I saw a bright blaze of light which seemed to go out at my eyes with a flash. Then I lost all sense of pain. But after I was cut down, I felt such intolerable pain from the prickings and shootings as my blood and spirits returned that I wished those who cut me down could have been hanged. Daniel P. Mannix, The History of Torture, New York, Dell, 1964. The reader may question how I find time to write this account on a sea voyage in a crowded forecastle. The answer is that I made very short notes each day, with the intent of expanding them later. I now have 2 hours of leisure each day to reconstruct a narrative from these notes, since Strobe has placed a desk and writing material at my disposal, being interested for some reason in printing my account. Each evening all the boys strip and wash in buckets of salt water, whereupon various sexual games and contests take place. In one such game each boy places a gold piece on the deck, and the first to ejaculate wins the gold. There are also contests for distance. Since there is plenty of powder and shot on board, there have been a few contests with pistols and muskets. I have won some gold, being careful not to best Kelly, though I am sure I could have done so. I feel that he could prove a most dangerous enemy. There is much here that I do not understand. Are you in salt? Back in New York I call the greens from my loft. I put $5,000 worth of security into this space, the windows are shatterproof glass with rolling bars. The door is 2 inches of solid steel from an old bank vault. It gives you a safe feeling, like being in Switzerland. Mr. Green can see me right away. He gives an address on Spring Street. Middle class loft, big modern kitchen. Siamese cat, plants. Mrs. Green is a beautiful woman, red hair, green eyes, a faraway dreamy look. I notice journeys out of the body, Psychic Discoveries Behind the Iron Curtain, The Castaneda Books. M.R. Green mixes me a Chivas Regal. I clarify my position, private. Investigator, no authority to make an arrest. I can only pass evidence along to the local police, frankly, in this case I can't hold out much hope of obtaining an arrest, let alone a conviction. We still want to retain you.
Why, exactly?
We want to know the truth, said Mrs. Green. Whether the killers can be brought to trial or not. I pull out the questionnaire with Jerry's medical history. It says here that Jerry had scarlet fever at the age of 4.
Yes.
We were living in St. Louis at the time, said Mrs. Green.
Who was the doctor?
Old Dr. Greenbaum. He lived next door.
Is he still alive?
No, he died 10 years ago.
And he made the diagnosis?
Yes.
Would you say that he was a competent diagnostician?
Not really, said Mr. Green.
But why is this important?
Jerry apparently had an attack of scarlet fever or something similar shortly before he was killed.
I turned to Mrs. Green.
Do you remember the details?
How the illness started?
Why, yes. It was a Thursday and he had taken a ride with an English governess we had them. When he got back he was shivering and feverish and he had a rash. I thought it was measles and called Dr. Greenbaum. He said it wasn't a measles rash, that it was probably a light case of scarlet fever. He prescribed oreomycin and the fever went away in a few days.
Was Jerry delirious at any time during this illness?
Yes, as a matter of fact he was. He seemed quite frightened and talked about animals in the wall.
Do you remember what animals, Mrs. Green?
He mentioned a giraffe and a kangaroo.
Do you remember anything else?
Yes, she said after a pause. There was a strange smell in the room, sort of a musky smell, like a zoo.
Did Dr. Greenbaum comment on this odor?
No, I think he had a cold at the time.
Did you notice it, Mr. Green?
Well, yes, it was on the sheets and blankets when we sent them to the cleaners.
Exactly how was Jerry killed, Mr. Snide?
A massive overdose of heroin.
He wasn't.
No, he wasn't an addict, and the Greek police are convinced the heroin was not self-administered.
Do you have any idea why he would have been murdered?
I'm not at all sure, Mr. Green. It could have been a case of mistaken identity. When I got to the office the next day, my assistant, Jim Brady, was already there, having come straight from the airport. He is very slim, 6 feet, 135 pounds, black Irish. Actually, he is 28, but he looks 18, and often has to show his ID card to be served in a bar. He handed me a packet from Athens, a photograph, and a message from Dimitri typed on yellow paper in telegraph style, have found villa where Jerry Green was killed stop on. Mainland 40 miles from Athens stop head still missing. Stop villa rented through London travel agency stop false. Name stop. Dimitri. The photo showed a bare high ceiling room with exposed beams. There was a heavy iron lantern hook in one beam. Dimitri had circled this hook in white ink and had written under it, traces of rope fiber.
A Mr. Everson called, said Jim.
His son is missing.
I made an appointment.
Where is he missing?
In Mexico.
A Mayan archaeologist.
Missing 6 weeks.
I sent Mr. Everson the questionnaire and asked him for pictures of the boy.
Good.
I had no special feeling about this case, but it was taking me in the direction I wanted to go. Back at the loft we decided to try some sex magic. According to psychic dogma, sex itself is incidental and should be subordinated to the intent of the ritual. But I don't believe in rules.
What happens, happens.
The altar is set up for an Egyptian rite timed for sunset, which is in 10 minutes. It is a slab of white marble about 3 feet square. We mark out the cardinal points. A hyacinth in a pot for earth, north. A red candle for fire,
south. An alabaster bowl of water for water, east. A glyph in gold on white parchment for air, west. We then put up the glyphs for the right, in gold on white parchment, on the west wall, since this is the sundown right and we are facing west. Also we place on the altar a bowl of water, a bowl of milk, an incense burner, some rose essence, and a sprig of mint. All set, we strip down to sky clothes and we are both stiff before we can get our clothes off. I pick up an ivory wand and draw a circle around our bodies while we both intone translations of the rite, reading from the glyphs on the wall. Let the shining ones not have power over me. Jim reads it like the Catholic litany and we are both laughing. I have purified myself. We dip water from the bowl and touch our foreheads. I have anointed myself with the unguents. We dip the special ointment out of an alabaster jar, touching foreheads, insides of the wrists, and the base of the spine, since the rite will have a sexual climax. I bring to you perfume and incense. We add more incense, a few drops of rose oil, and a pinch of benzoin to the burner. We pay homage to the four cardinal points as we invoke Set instead of Cantamantiu, since this is in some sense a black ritual. It is now exactly the hour of sunset, and we pay homage to Tem, since, Ra, in his setting, takes that name. We make lust rations with water and milk to the cardinal points, dipping a mint sprig into the bowls as we invoke the shining elementals. It is time now for the ritual climax, in which the gods possess our bodies and the magical incantation is projected in the moment of orgasm and visualized as an outpouring of liquid gold. My phallus is that of Amsu. I bend over and Jim rubs the ointment up my ass and slides his cock in. A roaring sound in my ears as pictures and tapes swirl in my brain. Shadowy figures rise beyond the candlelight, the goddess Nintab, patroness of those who hang themselves, a vista of gallows and burning cities from Bosch. Set. Osiris. Smell of the sea. Jerry hanging naked from the beam. A sweet rotten red musky metal smell swirls round our bodies palpable as a haze, and as I start to ejaculate, the room gets lighter. At first I think the candles have flared up and then I see Jerry standing there naked, his body radiating light. There is a skeleton grin on his face, which fades to the enigmatic smile on the statues of archaic Greek youths and then he changes into Dimitri, with a quizzical amused expression. So we send the shining ones home and go to bed. Why do you think the head was cut off? Asks Jim. Obvious reason, to obscure the cause of death in case the body was found. But they didn't figure on the body being found. There was some special purpose they had in mind, to use both the head and the body. Drawings of transplanted monkey heads flash in front of my eyes. Where do you think the head is now? In New York. Horse haddock. To ride. Next day when we got to the office there was a telegram from Dimitri, have suspect in custody who witnessed death of Jerry Green. Stop wire if wish to interview suspect. We took the next plane to Athens and checked into the Hilton. Dimitri sent a car for us. Jim was a bit stiff when they shook hands in Dimitri's air-conditioned office. Wall-to-wall blue carpet, a desk, leather-covered chairs, a picture of the Parthenon on the wall, everything neat and impersonal as a room in the Hilton. Dimitri raised one eyebrow. I infer you disapprove of our politics, Mr. Brady. For myself I disapprove of any politics. Please understand that I stand to gain nothing from this investigation. My political superiors want the whole thing dropped, a few degenerate foreigners, it's bad for the tourist business. Jim blushed sulkily and looked at his shoes and turned one foot sideways. What about this witness you got? I asked. Dimitri leaned back in his chair behind the desk and put the tips of his fingers together. Ah yes, Adam North, the perfect witness. Survived his perfection because he was in custody. On the morning that the Green Boy was killed, September 18th, young North was arrested with a quarter ounce of heroin in his possession. When I saw the laboratory report I ordered him placed in isolation. The heroin he had been buying from street pushers was about 10%. This was almost 100%. It would have killed him in a matter of seconds. Well, if they would kill him to shut him up about something, why let him know about it in the first place? Jim asked. A searching question. You see, he was a sort of camera from which a film could be withdrawn and developed. But first the bare bones, later the meat. Adam North had been approached by someone fitting. Dimitri glanced at me. Your description of Marty Bloom, and offered a quarter ounce of heroin plus $1,000 bonus to be paid in two installments to witness a magical ritual involving a simulated execution. He was suspicious. Dimitri turned on a tape recorder. Why me? Said a stupid surly young voice. It went on. Sought his character from a comic strip says I am a perfect. A perfect what? I ask him. A perfect witness, he tells me. He has 5 C notes in his hand. Well, all right, I say. But there is a condition, he says. You must promise to refrain from heroin or any other drug for 3 days prior to the ceremony. You have to be in a pure condition. Promise on my scout's honor, I told him, and he lays the bread on me. But one more thing, he says. He gives me a color picture of a kid with red hair who looks sorta like me. This is the subject. You will concentrate on this picture for the next 3 days. So I tell him sure and split. And would you believe it, with 500 cools in my pocket I can't score for shit nowhere no way. So when the chauffeur comes to pick me up in a Daimler I am sick as a dog. Dimitri shuts off the tape recorder. He was driven to a villa outside Athens where he witnessed a bizarre ceremony culminating in the hanging of the Green Boy. Back in Athens he was given the quarter ounce of heroin. He was on his way back to his girlfriend's apartment when the arrest was made. It still doesn't make any sense, Jim said. They drag him in as a witness, God knows why, then knock him to shut him up. They did not intend to shut him up. They intended to open him and extract the film. Adam North was a perfect witness. He is Jerry's age, born on the same day, and resembles him enough to be a twin brother. You are acquainted with the symptoms of heroin withdrawal, the painful intensity of impressions, light fever, spontaneous orgasms, a sensitized film. And a heroin overdose is the easiest of deaths, so the pictures registered on the sensitized withdrawal film come off without distortion in a heroin OD. I see, said Jim. It's all here on the tape, but I think you would like to see this boy. He is, I should tell you, retarded. As we are going down in the elevator, Dimitri continued. There is reason to suspect a latent psychosis, masked by his addiction. Is he receiving any medication? I asked. Yes, methadone, orally. I don't want his disorder to surface here. You mean that he could become a public charge? I asked. More than that, he could become a sanitary hazard. We saw Adam North in one of the interrogation rooms, under fluorescent lights. A table, a tape recorder, 4 chairs. He was a handsome blonde kid with green eyes. The resemblance to Jerry was remarkable. However, while Jerry was described as very bright and quick, this boy had a slack, vacuous, stupid look about him, sleepy and sullen like a lizard resentfully aroused from hibernation. Dimitri explained that we were investigators hired by Jerry's family, and we had a few questions. The boy looked down at the table in front of him and said nothing. This man who offered you the quarter ounce of H. You'd seen him before? I asked. Yeah. When I first came here he steered me to a score. I figure he is creaming off a percentage. What did he look like? Gray face, pock marks, stocky medium build, fancy purple vest and watch chain. Like he stepped out of the 1890s. Didn't seem to feel the heat. Anything else? Funny smell about him, like something rotten in a refrigerator. Please describe the ritual you witnessed, I said. Allow me, interrupted Dimitri. He looked at the boy and said, Ganymede. And snapped his fingers. The boy shivered and closed his eyes, breathing deeply. When he spoke, his voice was altered beyond recognition. I had the impression he was translating the words from another tongue, a language of giggles and turkey gobbles and coos and purrs and whimpers and trills. Ganymede Hotel, shutters closed, naked on the bed. Jerry's picture. It's coming alive, gets me hot to look at it. I know he's in a room just like this. Waiting, there's a smell in the room, his smell. I can smell what's going to happen, naked with animal masks, demon masks. I'm naked but I don't have a mask. We are standing on a stage, translucent noose, it's squirming like a snake. Jerry is led in naked by a twin sister, can't hardly tell them apart. There's a red haze over everything, and the smell. The kid whimpered and squirmed and rubbed his crotch. She's tying his hands behind him with a red scarf, she's got the noose around his neck. It's growing into him, his cock is coming up and he gets red all over right down to his toenails. We call it a red on. Adam giggled. The platform falls out from under him and he's hanging there kicking. He goes off three times in a row. His twin sister is catching the seed in a bottle. It's going to grow. The boy opened his eyes and looked uncertainly at Dimitri, who shook his head in mild reproof. You still think all this happened, Adam? Well, sure, doctor, I remember it. You remember dreams too. Your story has been checked and found to be without factual foundation. This was hardly necessary since you have been under constant surveillance since your arrival in Athens. The heroin you were taking has been analyzed. It contains certain impurities which can cause a temporary psychosis with just such bizarre hallucinations as you describe. We were looking for the wholesalers who were distributing this poisonous heroin. We have them now. The case is closed. I advise you to forget all about it. You will be released tomorrow. The consulate has arranged for you to work your way home on a freighter. The boy was led away by a white-coated attendant. What about the other witnesses, who wore masks? I asked Dimitri. I surmised that they would be eligible for immediate disposal. A charter plane for London leaving Athens the day after the ritual murder crashed in Yugoslavia. There were no survivors. I checked the passenger list with my police contacts in England. Seven of the passengers belonged to a druid cult suspected of robbing graves and performing black magic rituals with animal sacrifices. One of the animals allegedly sacrificed was a horse. Such an act is considerably more shocking to the British sensibility than human sacrifice. They sacrificed a horse. It's an old Scythian practice. A naked youth mounts the horse, slits its throat and rides it to the ground. Dangerous, I'm told. Rather like your American rodeos. What about the twin sister who hanged him? Jim demanded. Dimitri opened a file. She is a transvestite, Arne West, born Arnold Atkins at Newcastle upon Tyne. A top-flight ultra-expensive assassin specializing in sexual techniques and poisons. His consultation fee to listen to a proposition is $100,000, non-refundable. Known as the Popper, the Blue Octopus, the Siren Cloak. And now, would you gentlemen care to join me for dinner? I would like to hear from you, Mr. Snide, the complete story and a version edited for the so limited police mentality. Dimitri's house was near the American Embassy. It was not the sort of house you would expect a police official on a modest salary to own. It took up almost half a block. The grounds were surrounded by high walls, with 6 feet of barbed wire on top. The door looked like a bank vault. Dimitri led the way down a hall with red-tiled floor into a book-lined room. French doors opened onto a patio about 70 feet long and 40 feet wide. I could see a pool, trees, and flowers. Jim and I sat down and Dimitri mixed drinks. I glanced at the books, magic, demonology, a number of medical books, a shelf of Egyptology and books on the Mayans and Aztecs. I told Dimitri what I knew and what I suspected. It took about half an hour. After I had finished, he sat for some time in silence, looking down into his drink. Well, Mr. Snide, he said at last. It would seem that your case is closed. The killers are dead. But they were only.
Exactly, servants.
Dupes. Hired killers, paid off with a special form of death. You will recognize the rite as the Egyptian sunset rite dedicated to Set. A sacrifice involving both sex and death is the most potent projection of magical intention. The participants did not know that one of the intentions they were projecting was their own death in a plane crash. Any evidence of sabotage?
No.
But there was not much left of the plane. The crash occurred outside Zagreb. Pilot was off course and flying low. It looks like pilot error.
There are, of course, techniques for producing such errors.
You are still intending to continue on this case?
To find the higher UPS?
And why exactly?
Look, Colonel, this didn't start with the Green case. These people are old enemies.
Do not be in a hurry to dispose of old enemies.
What would you do without them?
Look at it this way, you are retained to find a killer.
You turn up a hired assassin.
You are not satisfied.
You want to find the man who hired him.
You find another servant.
You are not satisfied.
You find another servant, and another, right up to Mr. or Mrs. Big, who turns out to be yet another servant, a servant of forces and powers you cannot reach.
Where do you stop?
Where do you draw the line?
He had a point.
He went on, "Let us consider what has happened here. A boy has been hanged for ritual and magical purposes.
Is this so startling?
You have read The Bog People."
I nodded.
Well, a modest consumption of one nude hanging a year during the spring festivals, such festivals, within reason, could serve as a safety valve. After all, worse things happen every day. Certainly this is a minor matter compared with Hiroshima, Vietnam, mass pollution, droughts, famines. You have to take a broad general view of things. It might not be within reason at all. It might become pandemic.
Yes, the Aztecs got rather out of hand.
But you are referring to your virus theory.
Shall we call it virus B23?
The hanging fever?
And you are extrapolating from two cases which may not be connected.
Peter Winkler may have died from something altogether different.
I know you do not want to entertain such a possibility, but suppose that such an epidemic does occur.
He paused.
How old was Winkler?
In his early 50s.
So?
Jerry was a carrier of the illness.
He did not die of it directly.
Winkler, who was 30 years older, died in a few days.
Well, there are those who think a selective pestilence is the most humane solution to overpopulation and the attendant impasses of pollution, inflation, and exhaustion of natural resources.
A plague that kills the old and leaves the young, minus a reasonable percentage, one might be tempted to let such an epidemic run its course even if one had the power to stop it.
Colonel, I have a hunch that what we might find in the South American laboratories would make the story we heard from Adam North sound like a mild gothic romance for old ladies and children.
Exactly what I am getting at, Mr. Snide.
There are risks not worth taking.
There are things better left unseen and unknown.
But somebody has to see and know them eventually.
Otherwise there is no protection.
That somebody who has to see and know may not be you.
Think of your own life, and that of your assistant.
You may not be called upon to act in this matter.
You have a point.
He sure does, said Jim.
Mr. Snide, do you consider Hiroshima a crime?
Yes.
Were you ever tempted to go after the higher UPS?
No.
It wasn't my business.
The same considerations may apply here.
There is, however, one thing you can do. Find the head and exorcise it.
I have already done this with the body.
Mr.
Green agreed to burial here in the American cemetery.
He walked across the room to a locked cabinet and returned with an amulet, runic lettering on what looked like parchment in an iron locket.
Not parchment.
Human skin.
He told me.
The ceremony is quite simple. The head is placed in a magic circle on which you have marked the cardinal points. You repeat three times. Back to water. Back to fire. Back to air. Back to earth. You then touch the crown of the head, the forehead, and the spot behind the right ear. In this case, he was left-handed with the amulet. There was a knock at the door, and a middle-aged Greek woman with a mustache wheeled in the dinner of red mullet and Greek salad. After dinner and brandy, we got up to take our leave. I have said you may not be called upon to act. On the other hand, you may be called upon. You will know if this happens, and you will need help. I can give you a contact in Mexico City. 18 Callahan de la Esperance. Got it, said Jim. My driver will take you back to the Hilton. Nightcap. No, Jim said. I've got a headache. I'm going up to the room. I'll check the bar. See you very shortly. I had seen someone I knew from the American Embassy. Probably CIA. I could feel that he wanted to talk to me. He looked up when I walked in, nodded and asked me to join him. He was young, thin, sandy-haired, glasses, refined and rather academic-looking. He signaled the waiter and I ordered a beer. After the waiter had brought the beer and gone back to the bar, the man leaned forward, speaking in a low precise voice. Shocking thing about the green boy, he tried to look concerned and sympathetic but his eyes were cold and probing. I would have to be very careful not to tell him anything he didn't already know. Yes, isn't it? I understood it was a sex murder. He looked about as embarrassed and salacious as a shark. He was cold and fishy like the Countess de Gulpa. I remembered that he was rich. Something like that. It must have been terrible for the family. You didn't tell them the truth. Watch yourself, Clem. I'm not sure I know the truth. The story I actually told them is, of course, a confidential matter. Of course. Profession ethics. Without a trace of overt irony, he managed to convey a vast icy contempt for me and my profession. I just nodded. He went on. Strange chap, Dimitri. He seems very efficient. Very. It doesn't always pay to be too efficient. The Chinese say it is well to make a mistake now and then. Did you know that Dimitri has resigned? He didn't say so. He was the object of professional jealousy. Career men resent someone with independent means who doesn't really need the job. I should know. He smiled ruefully, trying to look boyish. Well, perhaps you can avoid the error of over-efficiency. He let that roll of him. I suppose these hippies go in for all sorts of strange far-out sex cults. I have found their sex practices to be on the whole rather boringly ordinary. You've read Future Shock, haven't you? Skip through it. It's worth looking at carefully. I found the biological time bomb more interesting. He ignored this. Dimitri's dabbling in magic hasn't done him any good either, career-wise, I mean. I could tell he knew I had just been to Dimitri's house for dinner. He was hoping I would tell him something about the house, books, decorations. Which meant he had never been there. A slight spasm of exasperation passed over his face like a seismic tremor. His face went dead and smooth as a mask, and he said slowly, "Isn't your assistant awfully young for the kind of work you're doing? Aren't you a bit young for the kind of work you're doing?" He decided to laugh. "Well, youth at the helm. Have another beer." "No thanks. Got an early plane to catch." I stood up. "Well, good night, Skipper." He decided not to laugh. He just nodded silently. As I walked out of the bar, I knew that he deliberately was not looking after me. No doubt about it. I had been warned in no uncertain terms to lay off and stay out, and I didn't like it, especially coming at a time when I had about decided to lay off and stay out. And I didn't like having Jim threatened by a snot-nosed CIA punk. The mafia couldn't have been much cruder. "Your assistant, very young man. You look at the book called Future Shock, maybe. When I got to the room, I found the door open. As I stepped in, I caught a whiff of the fever smell, the rank animal smell of Jerry's naked, headless body. Jim was lying on the bed, covered by a sheet up to his waist. As I looked at him, I felt a prick cling up the back of my neck. I was looking at Jerry's face, which wore a wolfish grin, his eyes sputtering green fire. Port Roger. Page from Strobe's notebook. The essence of sleight of hand is distraction and misdirection. If someone can be convinced that he has, through his own perspicacity, divined your hidden purposes, he will not look further. How much does he know or suspect? He knows that the capture was prearranged. He surmises an alliance between the pirates and the Pembertons, involving trade in the Western Hemisphere, the planting of opium in Mexico, and the cultivation of other crops and products now imported from the near and far east. He suspects, or soon will, that this alliance may extend to political and military revolution, and secession from England and Spain. What does he this is expected from him? The role of gunsmith and inventor, which is partially true. I must not underestimate him. He has already quite literally seen through Mr. Thomas. How long before he will see through the others? Must be careful of Kelly. The most necessary servants are always the most dangerous. He is a cunning and devious little beast. Noah writes that I am interested in publishing his diaries for some reason. Does he have any inkling what reason? He must be kept very busy as a gunsmith lest he realize his primary role. How long will it take him to find out that Captain Jones and Captain Nordenhals are interchangeable? To grasp for the matter the full significance of his own name? To see that I am the De Fuentes twins? Finally, to know that I am also? Scarf around his neck immediately arranged between them, turning to leer and wink at the armory. I am Captain Strobe, a slim siren. Coat glittering in the sun, flute from a distant star in their buttocks. Now I was smoke called Kelly pale in my mind together with a yes. Sandy hairs, member erect marching around was cleared. Dancing boys to the music played their bags wriggling, pale groin toes twisted. We now have a double crew down the Red Sea area. Story started with an argument, sentences to hang. The sentence preyed on merchant vessels carrying the cargo beautiful hanged back to life, women dancing lewdly and ensuring protection against their bodies once one had been rescued. He claimed to have learned the gallows smile. Gasping, his lips back surged erect, he ejaculated noose and knot feet across the floor. Spirits around his neck. Spurting 6. Today we reached Port Roger on the coast of Panama. This was formerly Fort Pheasant and had been used as a base by English pirates 60 years ago. The coast here is highly dangerous for the navigation of large vessels, owing to shallows and reefs. Port Roger is one of the few deep water harbors. It is, however, so difficult to reach that only a navigator with exact knowledge of the passage can hope to do so. The coastline is a distant green smudge on our starboard side. Strobe and Thomas scan the skyline with telescopes. Guarda Costa. The boys mutter uneasily. Capture by the Spanish means torture or, at best, slavery. If overtaken by a Spanish ship, we will abandon ship in the lifeboats, leaving the Great White to the Spanish. The boarding party will receive a surprise, for I have arranged a device which will explode the entire cargo of powder as soon as the doors to the hold are opened. Now the ship rounds and heads towards land. Strobe, stripped to the waist, has taken the wheel, his thin body infused with alertness. Two boys are taking soundings on both sides, and the escort ship is 100 yards beyond us. We are sailing through a narrow channel in a reef, Mr. Thomas and Kelly calling out orders as the ship slips like a snake through a strip of blue water. The coastline is ever clearer, trees slowly appearing and low hills in a shimmer of heat. An inaudible twang like a loosed bowstring as the ship glides into a deep blue harbor a few 100 yards from the shore, where waves break on a crescent of sand. We drop anchor a bare 100 yards from the beach, the siren a like distance behind us. From the harbor the town is difficult to discern, being sheltered by a thick growth of bamboo and set among trees and vines. I had the curious impression of looking at a painting in a gold frame, the two ships riding at anchor in the still blue harbor, a cool morning breeze, and written on the bottom of the frame, Port Roger. April 1, 1702. The oarsmen. Thin copper red bodies leaning against the oars as boats glide forward in a silver spray of surf and flying fish against a background of beach and palm trees. Unloading the cargo. Bright red gums, sharp white teeth, buttocks exposed as the cargo is passed over the side with much singing and laughter. The boys make up songs about the cargo as it is passed along to the rafts and relayed to the beach. These songs, translated by Kelly, who has sidled up to me in his pushy ghost way, seem flatly idiotic. The boys are unloading powder kegs. We offer to help, but the Indians sing. White man's hands slippery like rotten bananas. Now they pass up the powder kegs. This go boom boom up questions s. I ask Kelly, what is this question? Short for Inquisition. Boy holds up keg of opium. Spanish no get this, shit come in pants, very dirty muy sucio. And Kiki is getting a hard on because he knows I look at his asshole when he bends over for opio. I was thinking of Maria. Take off the cloth and show us Maria. Kiki blushes, but he must obey the rules of this game. He takes off his loincloth, smiling shyly to reveal lush purple pink genitals, nuts tight, cock straining up, the flower smell of it fills the hold. Maria his asshole. I fuck him her spurt 6 feet. He looks around, challenging the boys who sit on the opium kegs. Some of the boys extract gold nuggets from little pouches at their belts cunningly contrived from Spanish testicles. He love this so much I keep it in his nuts. Soon get rich like him. That should be easy for a bastard like you. Put your yellow shit where your mouth is, sister fucker. I see you do it with my own eyes. An area is cleared and carefully measured off and the bets placed. Kiki bends over, hands on knees. The other boy, who looks like Kiki's twin brother, uncorks a little phallus-shaped vessel of pink coral, and a powerful odor fills the hold, already heavy with the smells of opium, hashish, and salt water drying on young bodies. The reek from the pink coral container is a heavy sweet rotten musky smell like a perfumed corpse, or like the smell you catch after lightning strikes. The unguent glistens in the dim light of the hold, where red limbs stir lazily like fish in black water. Now the boy rubs the glowing unguent up Kiki's ass and Kiki writhes and bares his teeth as the other boy slides it in and they both light up and glow. For a moment the hold is bright as day with every face and body clearly outlined. Radiant boys. Bucking for radiant bars, Kelly mutters sourly. Radiant bars? I ask. Yeah. It's the old army game from here to eternity. Now you may know radiant boys is a special type ghost, when you see one you die soon after. Of course you can get used to anything and bright boys is all in the day's work to me. Now a good strong radiant boy can light up a room with a 20-foot ceiling. One of the best lived in an Irish castle and was the ghost of a 10-year-old boy strangled by his insane mother. That one killed 3 cabinet ministers and the vicar. So the dirty trick boys get wind of this good thing and set up Project RB to take care of key enemy personnel. They don't even know what buttons to push. Project RB is dumped into the lap of us tech sergeants. We get half hanged, half drowned, half strangled, the medics pawing us over. How did it feel? Did you get radiant? Put your shit where the bice were. Radiant boys is a special strike of death. The ghost lacks water. And a powerful odor filled the RB project. Half hanged half bodies, the smell is pawing us over. Sweet rotten musky smell like. Then some smart pants come lately pulls the radiant ass out from under you and makes shave tail out of it. Facts of like in the army. Uncorks the old army game screwing tech sergeant like me. Both his words and manner of speech seemed at first unfamiliar to me, and yet somehow they stirred memories as an actor might be stirred by the forgotten lines of some role he had played far away and long ago. Captain Nordenhals disembarks at Port Roger. There he is standing on a ruined pier left over from the English in some uniform of his own devising. He is flanked by Opium Jones, the De Fuentes twins and Captain Strobe, all looking like a troop of traveling players a bit down on their luck but united in determination to play out their assigned roles. Boys trail behind them, carrying an assortment of bags, cases, and chests. They walk across the beach and disappear one after another into a wall of leaves. I don't know what gave me such an impression of shabbiness about this procession, since they all must have chests of gold and precious stones, but for a moment they appeared to my eyes as seedy players with grand roles but no money to pay the rent. The jewels and the gold are false, the curtains patched and shredded and torn, the theater long closed. I was smitten by a feeling of sadness and desolation, as the words of the immortal bard came to my mind. There are actors. As I foretold you, we're all spirits, and are melted into air. We have landed. Captain Strobe meets us on the beach emerging from a picture puzzle, his shirt and pants splotched with green and brown, stirring slightly in the afternoon breeze. We follow him as he walks towards a seemingly unbroken line of undergrowth. He pushes aside branches to reveal a winding path through a tangle of bamboo and thorn. We walk for perhaps a quarter mile as the path winds upward and ends in a screen of bamboo. We are quite close before I realize that the bamboo trees are painted on a green door that swings open like the magic door in a book I have seen somewhere long ago. We step through into the town of Port Roger. We are standing in a walled enclosure like a vast garden, with trees and flowers, paths and pools. I can see buildings along the sides of the square, all painted to blend with the surroundings so that the buildings seem but a reflection of the trees and vines and flowers stirring in a slight breeze that seems to shake the walls, the whole scene insubstantial as a mirage. This first glimpse of Port Roger occurred just as some hashish candy I had ingested on the boat started to take effect, producing a hiatus in my mind and the interruption of verbal thought, followed by a sharp jolt as if something had entered my body. I caught a whiff of perfume and a sound of distant flutes. A long cool room with a counter, behind which are three generations of Chinese. A smell of spices and dried fish. An Indian youth, naked except for a leather pouch that cups his genitals, is leaning forward on the counter examining a flintlock rifle, his smooth red buttocks protruding. He turns and smiles at us, showing white teeth and bright red gums. He has a gardenia behind his ear and his body gives off a sweet flower smell. Hammocks, blankets, machetes, cutlasses, and flintlocks are on the counter. Outside in the square, Strobe introduces me to a man with a strong square face, light blue eyes, and curly iron gray hair. This is Waring. He painted the town. Waring gives me a smile and a handshake. He makes no secret of his dislike for Captain Strobe. Dislike is perhaps too strong a word since there is no hatred involved on either side. They meet as emissaries of two countries whose interests do not coincide at any point. I do not yet know what countries they represent. Up to this moment I have been so completely charmed by Strobe's nonchalance that I have never stopped to ask myself, what is the source of his poise? Where did he buy it, and what did he pay? I see now that Strobe is an official and so is Waring, but they don't work for the same company. Perhaps they are both actors who never appear on stage together, their relationship limited to curt off-stage nods. I'll show you to your digs, says Strobe. We go through a massive studded door into a patio, cool and shady with trees, flowering shrubs, and a pool. The patio is a miniature version of the town square. My attention is immediately arrested by a youth who is standing about 30 feet from the entrance executing a dance step, one hand on his hip and the other above his head. He has his back towards us and as we enter the courtyard he freezes in mid-step, turning his head to point towards us. At this moment, everyone in the patio looks at us. The youth pivots and advances to meet us. He is wearing a purple silk vest which is open in front, and his arms are bare from the shoulders. His arms and torso are dark brown, lean and powerful, and he moves with the grace of a dancer. His complexion is dark, his hair black and kinky, one eye is gray-green, the other brown. A long scar runs down the left cheekbone to the chin. He makes a mock obeisance in front of Captain Strobe, who acknowledges it with his cool enigmatic smile. Then the youth turns to Bert Hansen, the son of family. He sniffs. The smell of gold is always welcome. I notice that he can be warm and friendly from one eye and at the same time cold and mocking from the other. The effect is most disturbing. Bert Hansen, not knowing how to respond, smiles uncomfortably, and his smile is immediately mimicked by the youth with such precision that it seems for a moment they have switched places. He ruffles the cabin boy's hair. An Irish leprechaun. To Paco he says something in Portuguese. I recognize him as the regimental or shipboard joker and master of ceremonies, and Paco tells me his name is Juanito. I have no doubt that Juanito can, if necessary, back his sharp tongue with knife or cutlass. Now it is my turn. I extend my hand, but instead of shaking it he turns it over and pretends to read the palm. You are going to meet a handsome stranger. He beckons over his shoulder and calls out, Hans. A boy who is standing by the pool throwing bits of bread to the fish turns and walks towards me. Wearing only blue trousers, he is shirtless and barefoot, with yellow hair and blue eyes. His tan torso is smooth and hairless. Noah, the gunsmith, meet Hans, the gunsmith. Hans brings his heels together and bows from the waist as we shake hands. He invites me to move into his room. The patio is completely surrounded by a two-story wooden building. The second floor rooms open onto a porch which runs all around the upper story and overhangs the ground floor. The rooms have no doors, but at the top of the entrance there is a roll of mosquito netting which is lowered at twilight. The rooms are bare whitewashed cubicles with hooks for slinging hammocks and in the walls wooden pegs for clothes. I take my gear to a room on the second floor and Hans introduces me to an American boy from Middletown who also shares the room. His name is Dink Rivers. His extraordinarily clear and direct gray eyes convey a shock of surprise and recognition as if we had known one another from somewhere else, and for a second I am in a dry stream bed and he says, if you still want me you'd better take me up soon. Next second I am back in the room at Port Roger, and we are shaking hands and he is saying, nice to see you. When I inquire as to his trade, he says that he is in physical education. Hans explains that he is a student and instructor in body control. He can stop his pulse, jump from 20 feet, stay underwater 5 minutes and Hans grins go off no hands. When I asked the boy to make a demonstration, he looked at me very earnestly without smiling and said that he would so when the time came. There are 4 latrines, 2 for the ground floor and 2 for the upper floor, with toilets that can be flushed from a water tank which fills with rainwater drained off the roof. The patio contains a number of fig, orange, mango, and avocado trees and a menagerie of cats, iguanas, monkeys, and strange gentle animals with long snouts. On the ground floor there is a communal dining room, a kitchen, and a large bath where hot water is drawn into buckets. This is an Arab-style bath known as a hammam. The dancing boy are spreading mats under the portico, lighting their hashish pipes and brewing the sweet mint tea they drink constantly. Chinese youths are smoking opium. The entire crew of the Siren is housed here, and it is a mixed company, English, Irish, American, Dutch, German, Spanish, Arabs, Malay, Chinese, and Japanese. We stroll about, talking and introducing ourselves among the murmur of many tongues. Old acquaintances are renewed and bonds of language and common places of origin discovered. There are some boy from New York who had been river pirates, and it turns out that they know Guy, Bill, and Adam. 5 huge Nubians, liberated by Nordenhals from a slave ship, speak a language known only to themselves. Now word is passed along through Kelly and Juanito the Joker that Nordenhals will entertain us all for dinner at his house. Hans looks at me with a knowing smile. Fräuleins. He punches his finger in and out of his fist. The word echoes through the patio in many languages. Hans explains that there will be a number of women at the party who have come for the purpose of becoming impregnated. Mother is the best bet. At twilight we make our way towards the house of Skipper Nordenhals, which is outside the town on higher ground overlooking the bay. He receives us in a large courtyard covered with lattice and mosquito netting. He has a thin aristocratic face, green eyes, a continual ironic smile, and an oblique way of talking and glancing down his nose at the same time. Most glad to welcome you.